Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, April 30th, 2011. My name's Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic is disaster relief with a question mark, Glass-Steagall. That is the disaster relief that for the world, actually. And our topic continues with this, that we are Glass-Steagall will end Obama's Haiti treatment of the United States and the world. Now, with us to discuss this, I'm very glad that we have from the War Room of the LaRouche Political Action Committee, TV team, actually, Dennis Mason. Welcome, Dennis.
Hi.
And you may have seen, I mentioned War Room. If you go on LaRouchePAC.com to the War Room, naturally you see many feature videos, but just a couple of days ago, Dennis hosted a special video on Bird's Point levees, the Bird's Point levee out in the Mississippi. Who is in charge? He will be talking about this more. But first, let me also welcome two more people on our guest panel from the flood zone in the Ohio Valley, from Indiana, Carol Smith. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And also in Indiana, but hailing from Kentucky, John Miller. Welcome, John.
Hi, great to be here.
And they, in particular, will have a great deal to say, well, about whatever they want to, but Glass-Steagall, the fight to have that reinstated yesterday, actually. But we have Congress coming back 3 days from now to Washington, D.C. They've been in their home districts for 2 weeks on the Easter break. And the last thing that has been going on is any kind of lobbying as usual for some necessary policy like Glass-Steagall. But before we get to that, let me just turn to the weather. Usually that's a mundane topic, but you know why I am turning to that now. What we've seen in the United States in the last week are manifestations of, in fact, the kind of hyperactivity in the weather patterns of our planet, in the solar system, in the larger cycles of the galaxy. That is, we've seen epic storms, rainfall. Look at it in two ways in particular, geographically. You had the fierce tornado storm wave that swept over 48 hours from Texas, actually all the way up into New England, but the six southern states most intensely hit have a death toll already of 350. They have record numbers and intensity, I think, of tornadoes, including supercells, including tornado tracks that were longer than you almost ever see. The past record for numbers of deaths, unfortunately, was in 1974 with 310. So you have seen this tremendous devastation, Alabama in particular, but in the other states. Now, that speaks for itself about what kind of extreme weather that we're undergoing. But also, at the same time, you have the corridor from Texas more northeasterly up through the Mississippi and Ohio Basin states, including, you can see them, parts of Louisiana, Arkansas, Missouri, Tennessee, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, where our guests are, and others. And the waters have been rising. At certain points, the height is going to exceed the 1937 height. There have been other high periods, but you have both the Ohio and Mississippi very high. And so the volume and speed of the water is tremendous. And again, speaking of both of these kinds, whether it's tornadoes or whether it's simply torrential runoff, the amount of cloud formation in over 20 states, the dumping of huge amounts of water, is setting records, even if it's not as dramatic as a twister like that went through Tuscaloosa. I think Kentucky may have more rain as of the end of tonight than its history. I think something close to 14 inches in 1 month. Indiana's similar, but parts of southeastern Missouri, near the Mississippi River, in the Ozarks there, had 16 inches in 4 days. So I'm mentioning some of the empirics, some of the on-the-ground specifics of what happened, relatively speaking, all at the same time in the last 7 days, because this is the kind of reality that Lyndon LaRouche, that other individuals around the world in collaboration or in co-thinking have been warning of for a long time, but certainly for some months, connected with the reality that whether it's earthquake threat in the Rim of Fire and elsewhere, the Pacific Rim of Fire I'm speaking of, whether it's seismic activation in on other land masses and under the seas around the world, or these kinds of storm formations, we are in that period of the what you could call the solar flare or sunspot cycle. And that's the reality we should be dealing with. That's how we should define the meaning of preparedness. But instead, we're getting what you've been seeing with the way President Obama says, you know, I feel for you and goodbye. You know, I'm going to go play basketball. So this is what we're discussing now. We don't want to have any hesitation. There's been a tremendous mobilization in recent days that you'll hear our guests talk about to order Washington to reinstate Glass-Steagall, that is a credit system principle, which is the legacy of our nation and our Constitution, and end this casino monetarist system, which is dying anyway, and instead of taking everybody with it, we want a future, we want to do this. So I've said or described some of of the dramatic economic events of the week. But Dennis, what I'd like to do is have you start. You might want to open the discussion with the way you reported on certain developments of the flooding in the Mississippi-Ohio system. You said this is an opportunity for us. Could you pick up on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, well, what's important is that Mr. LaRouche has been going after everything that's been happening right now as one and the same crisis. People can review the weekly report that was posted on the LPAC website this past week. And that's very important to make sense of what's going on, because on the one hand, yes, you have the floods, you have tornadoes, you have seismic activity all over the place, the major earthquake that occurred in Japan, and all of this. But these are really reflections of a more galactic sort of process in which we find ourselves. And that's really what we're facing right now, which is something that if you're thinking from the standpoint of what is necessary for human life to continue to exist and develop on planet Earth, and when you think about that in relationship to things that we do know, such as, for example, everybody knows about the extinction of the dinosaurs, right? Mm-hmm. They got wiped out. Now, you know, they say that it was an asteroid or whatever, but as we've been looking at, we developed more on the LPAC site, is that there are the five major extinction periods that we know about coincide with a 62-million-year process of our travel through the galaxy. And that is really where we need to be looking in terms of statecraft, in terms of how to deal with the day-to-day kind of exigencies, types of emergencies that we're looking at, to be more concrete about that. When you take something like the Mississippi Riverway as an entirety, in the 20s, you know, we had devastating flood all across that riverway, and so we took it upon ourselves to do something about that. Now, we had plans to have water management, etc., for the riverway taken as a whole. This, of course, was never completed. Now, to my thinking, when you gear your nation toward dealing with what's necessary for, you know, defending human life, what's necessary for providing the common defense, not just against some kind of military triumph, but against the elements, and providing for promoting the general welfare nationwide. If your economy is geared toward that, and you already have the types of processes in motion, such as building up your riverways, building up new cities, exploring space, and these kinds of things, then at that point you have more of a capability to deal with the effects of the different weather-related crises. For example, we had 350 people so far that have died in this tornado season. And keep in mind, too, that normally, right, tornado season lasts, somewhere between April and June, right? So we're still at the very early end of things, and we're already breaking records. Now, a lot of those deaths, I'm sure, are caused not just by the fact that, you have a huge, cataclysmic tornadoes ripping through, but the fact that our collapse in infrastructure, whether it be on from the standpoint of the efficiency of the strength of buildings, or the ability to warn people, or the ability to carry out actions based on the warnings, all of this has just been taken down for years and years and years. Now, if we were to use this crisis as it's unfolding on the riverway, as it's unfolding with the tornadoes, as it will unfold with different seismic activity, whether that be earthquakes, etc., we can use this as an opportunity to say, all right, we've been lackadaisical as a nation for many decades now. Let's get off our ass and start rebuilding our nation. And we have all the resources available for us to do that. Now, the problem, one major problem, is that we're not going to do that if Barack Obama is in office. It's not possible. As long as he remains in office, the monetary policy is going to remain the same, which is to bail out, just print out money in order to try and keep the banking system afloat, which that's not going to work. What we need to do is have Glass-Steagall voted up. That will give us the basis by which we can issue credit. And with that credit, then we can tend to these kinds of things. For example, with the tornadoes and the floods, we have a large problem with the farming in terms of debris on the field, fields being ripped up, fields being flooded over, such that we need to deal with reseeding whatever fields are still that have been damaged by the storms but are still usable, and then to take it further from that, then begin to reclaim some of this farmland, to reclaim the river system for the use of man. These are the types of things that we can do once we have the credit to do that, but we can't do that as long as Barack Obama is still in office.
Right. Well, that takes us, Carol. Why don't we go to you and you? First there, I want to ask you two things. You've been taking this to people, the kind of thing that Dennis was just saying, and you're right there in the flood zone. For the past 2 weeks, when congressmen have been back home or the state representatives, many of them have been meeting with the Army Corps in emergency meetings about what their situation is. But do you want to describe what you've been doing?
Sure. Gosh, we've been very, very busy. And what? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you just fine.
Okay.
Thank
John,
you.
John wasn't hearing me.
Okay.
Anyways, we have been, oh my gosh. I live 35, 40 miles from Louisville, Kentucky, where I work.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been traveling to Indianapolis, which is, 2.5 hours north of me, to Frankfort over in Kentucky, and not this round, but previously, all the way to Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
talking about the Glass-Steagall and the HBPA for the past 4 years. So this recent stuff, the Tea Party people have really been open. It's I go to the one here in Corden, where I live, mm-hmm. and one in Clarksville, in right across the river. And we spoke at the city council meeting and then the county council meeting last night or a couple nights ago,
mm-hmm.
and a very unbelievable thing happened. There was one council person who was very open, and he even said that this looks like what we need to do, because what they're doing is not working. So I had sent him, because it happened the next day, I had sent him Marcy Kaptur's letter asking all of the Congress people to do this. He sends it, unbeknownst to me, he sends it to the Tea Party people.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells them, you guys may want to send this up also. And he says, we heard a presentation on this last meeting. So then one of the Tea Party guys, he takes the letter on the internet and puts in, you know, signature lines and everything and sends it out to all of his people. So we've got these Tea Party people working with the council, passing it out and getting signatures, and he says he's going to hand deliver them to the new congressman here in southern Indiana.
So this is this kind of activation, you're saying, for, and of course people know this was H.R. 1489,
right.
The bill that will reinstate Glass-Steagall. It was introduced, what, April 17th by the Ohio Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And
so they've taken it on themselves. They've taken it on themselves to work on this. And then I got a phone call, and this is what is really interesting, because this woman named Tamara, she is with the Move On people. She called me the same day I got these emails from the Tea Party people working together to get out Glass-Steagall and get it to Todd. Tama is she's told me she's created an online petition for Glass-Steagall, and she's wanting to print it out, and we've got this big event on Sunday, and she's wanting to get signatures on it and turn it in. So you've got the Tea Party people working on it, and then you've got their nemesis, the Move On people. Working on the same, you know, issue, Glass-Steagall.
Well, I have to tell, let me just pass along something here, because Mr. LaRouche was giving a meeting with staff this morning on a kind of status report or where we are, and he said, okay, he went through the dramatic tornado waves, the floods, the world picture, as Dennis did too, in its galactic sense, and said, you know what that means? Obama's presidency is gone. It is dead. There is no now politics as usual of Republican and Democrat, Carol, in the usual labels that they
mm-hmm.
wear.
Mm-hmm.
It's all, and also we've only had just a wave of this kind of, we could have an earthquake next week. I'm not just scaremongering or mongering. That's what we're talking about. But there is no... This any kind of politics as usual, states and localities, you see that in Alabama now, can't function. We have to have this Glass-Steagall and the credit system because they're underwater, they're rubble fields, they're... So you've just described that dynamic with the Tea Party and Move On.
Mm-hmm.
And you've also been at meetings, this was earlier before the... But only a few days ago, right, of some of the congressmen directly, right?
Yes. Well, I took previously, a few weeks ago, these same two Tea Party groups had actually signed petitions at their party, at their, you know, event, and I had taken them and dropped them off at the new congressman's office.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the labor people I've been talking to all over Indianapolis and in Kentucky, and, you know, going to these, I was actually MC for one of the Move On events.
Okay.
That asked me to do that, you know, and we spoke about it there. And it's just been everybody talking about it. And I haven't, unlike any other campaign that I've been involved with over the past 15, 16 years with LPAC and LaRouche, I have not gotten a single person that was against Glass-Steagall.
Mm-hmm.
Once they understood what it was, Tama, she's like, "Well, I knew about that, but I didn't know the name of it."
Mm-hmm.
And our my poster says, "What's the problem? Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
What's the solution? Glass-Steagall." So simple, you know, one side. And if they don't know, I mean, everybody knows what Wall Street, you know, that these bailouts and, you know, all this insanity is the biggest problem we have. And then they want to know more about, you know, Glass-Steagall.
Right. By the way, we can go on. There are many leads here to pursue. But one thing I'd like you to just say, you said before the show the sun is out. What about the physical side of the actual rise of the Ohio and so forth? I understand it's going down a bit now. But just as a local citizen, you've been driving across the bridge. I am glad to hear Louisville's flood walls are holding. But could you say something about it, Carol, and then John?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I don't recall it looking at, you know, that bad, that high before. And, you know, what it does to the surroundings and the congestion and everything else like that. They say it wasn't, you know, like this except back in 97, but I don't remember being this bad.
It's pretty high. The big problem here, and I drive back and forth between Louisville and Kentucky, or between Cordon and Kentucky every day, but it's very high, but unfortunately this is the Kentucky Derby Festival, so it's pretty much put a damper on that. So we're in the process of getting ready for the big 2-minute horse race.
Okay. Anyway, Dennis may have more questions, but one thing, Carol, you mentioned in 16 years and so forth. I know in a few years ago, when you were working hard in the Midwest, you were among people who helped organize meetings in Louisville about the water infrastructure, the locks and dams that Dennis was talking about should be totally built out.
Yeah.
And Mr. LaRouche came there for the meeting, and
absolutely,
he went to St. Louis, he went to Detroit, and... do you want to say more about the fact that, you organized that we should retool a lot of the auto sector that was in crisis to do this, but of course this was whipped by the monetarist political factions internationally.
Yeah.
But how about, go ahead, say something about this.
Well, I was going to say back in 2005, Scotty Pulliam with the IBEW, they had...
The Electrical Workers Union.
Right, right. They pulled together a lot of the building trades for a really, really nice, you know, it was a well-attended meeting. And I remember people in there complaining about, you know, all these plans. They had all these, you know, written up blueprints and ready to go. And they just, you know, there was nobody, the money was not coming through for them. They admitted, you know, that they were so behind in just maintenance, let alone anything new. That you know, he was just. I remember one carpenter in particular who just challenged. he challenged us, you know, us working with LaRouche and Mr. LaRouche to unfreeze the money, to get the money flowing to them so they could do this, because they knew, you know, down the road we were going to have major problems with all this infrastructure and the antiquity of it.
Right. And he was referring to to upgrading the Ohio locks and dams, not just at Louisville, but everywhere, right?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
All the way up.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So, yeah, that's what's key with reinstating Glass-Steagall, is because then you have the basis by which you can deal with these sorts of things from the standpoint of what the nation needs as a mission orientation. Because... as it stands right now, right, you have the case, which I had covered in that video with the Birds Point levee, where you have municipalities or local levels fighting over how to best manage the infrastructure. Or in a lot of cases, up and down the riverway, you've had different levees, different locks and dams, which have been privatized. And then as they become privatized, then, you know, the people who are in control of them, who are interested in profit, they don't necessarily maintain them. And then, you know, once they fail their Army Corps of Engineers rating, then, you know, you lose federal money to help maintain those things. And it's a total downward spiral when you're thinking about all of these things from a piecemeal kind of mentality. Whereas if when we get Glass-Steagall reinstated and issued a credit and look at this thing from a national mission objective, that's a much better basis. And you just can't do that within a monetary system. It's just not possible trying to balance budgets and things like that. There's no way it would happen. You actually have to take, instead of looking at everything in dollar denominations, which you know, most people do right now, because that's we live in a monetarist, lived under a monetarist empire for quite some time now. What we do instead is, if you at first look at what is it that we need to accomplish as a nation, what is it that we need to accomplish as a people in order to, you know, defend ourselves from the elements, in order to continue to develop, begin to explore space, use that, what we're going to do, human activity in the universe in which we find ourselves, use that as the basis for determining what kind of programs need to be in place, what needs to be built, and this kind of thing. When you put that first and then figure out, now how do we fund that, that's that difference in thinking about economy is something that I think is one reason why people are across party lines, across everything else. It's really a question of, are you a patriotic citizen of a republic, the United States of America, which we think about, you know, we conquered space, we conquered this and conquered that, right? That the line is drawn more between that and those who want to uphold this empire. And, you know, it's kind of a funny thing, because you brought up earlier, Carol, how, you know, everybody is organizing around for this Glass-Steagall. One thing that we're looking at in terms of when these representatives come back on Monday to Washington, D.C., so is a lot of these representatives agree as well. They think the Glass-Steagall is a good idea. But the problem, one of the main problems that we face right now, is the willingness to fight for it. You can have everybody in the world support it, but if it doesn't come up for a vote, if people don't go against the pressure from the Wall Street crowd, the Inter-Alpha Banking crowd, the monetarist empire, if people don't stand up against this narcissistic bully called our president, if the drive to fight for the policy isn't there, if we don't burn the tail of these representatives to make them bring this up to a vote, then it's kind of a moot point. If the whole choir is singing, that's wonderful, but we've got to actually do it now.
What Dennis just said, Carol, reminds me, you have one new, both Kentucky and Indiana now have more Republicans than Democrats in their congressional delegation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those newly elected ones, your own, Todd Young, right?
Right.
He's just in there since last November, but would you go through? He actually said in his campaign, or he told you during his campaign period, he'd support Glass-Steagall, right?
Absolutely. And like I said, you know, these Tea Party people, they know that.
Uh-huh.
And you know, they are just pulling him up on that. As a matter of fact, Steve, this is a guy from the Cordon Tea Party, in his note to me and to everybody on his there, he says, "Dear friends, I feel we are on the brink of success with this critically important issue. Sign this petition and get it to me personally for delivery to our congressman, or bring it to our next Cordon Tea Party." So they are on Todd Young. I mean, he is getting pressure on him, definitely. And John wanted to say something on that, because he was actually
please
at a meeting.
John, go ahead, please.
Yeah, the other day I was, Carol and I were kind of split in two different directions, so I went to Todd Young's town hall meeting, and he gave his, you know, canned GOP thing about austerity, et cetera. And then I was still in my work clothes, so I was wearing a suit and tie, and I raised my hand. Of course, they called on me first, assuming I would give them a nice softball thing, and I gave them about 2 minutes on Glass-Steagall. And then I said that, "Now, Mr. Young, you promised us before you were elected that you would support this if this came up, and are you going to be able to keep that promise?" And boy, he was sweating bullets. He wouldn't commit to anything. You know, we got to look at this, et cetera, because he's pretty bought and paid for. So anyway, that was a fairly interesting little escapade. But hopefully, all the people there—there's 75 or 100 people there—heard my 2 minutes on Glass-Steagall, and he nodded all the way through it. You know, when I said, you know, the reason we're in this mess is the trillions of bailout money that we've paid out. So,
right. Well, I think that's the point, right? So, and it's to quote one of our great forebears, "We've only begun to fight." They'll be back on Monday, Tuesday, but that doesn't mean they're going to be in the clear, just the opposite with what we're describing.
Yeah, well, you know, I reminded Todd that I met him at one of these, the Clarksville Tea Party event, and he was speaking that night, and I was speaking the next week when I was running for U.S. Congress against Barron Hill. And I told him, you know, after the, you know, after the primaries, and he won, you know, the Republican one, and Barron Hill won the Democrat one.
Okay.
I told him, I said, look, I said, I'm a registered Democrat, but I said, this is the issue for me. And that's when he told me that he would support it. And, you know, he's not coming forward with his promise. So I'm reminding everybody constantly of this.
Right. Well, one thing we can reiterate again, you may want to add things here or not, about that we've seen 2 years, and way before that, but intensively since 2007, counties and localities, small villages or the big cities, Chicago or Louisville or what, making drastic cuts in their government functions, fire, police, teachers we've seen, public school nurses, public health services, local clinics, and now these very same places, some of which, by the way, Dennis, they weren't privatizing their levees. Some of them, local districts, had them all along. You know, they had them for 150 years. It's just if things were, if the economy was functioning, it's okay. You know what I mean? They would keep them up just the way you described, in collaboration with the Army Corps or the Agriculture Department, had a huge number of thousands of what they call upper watershed dams in the smaller rivers. But none of this is now working. You see it in Alabama, but counties, local villages, towns, and now they are disaster weather striking, and it's just the first wave. Who says it's, as you said, this is we have months to go in so-called tornado season. So do you want to say anything about that, John, in Kentucky, or anything in your part of the world, about the localities, whether it's counties or towns, that are dealing, that some of them, their farmland's under the water, their towns are under the water. Cairo, Illinois, has 2,800 people in an emergency situation. Do you want to say anything about the non-functioning because of the government on the local level?
Well, Louisville is probably a bad example of how to keep up your sewer system, et cetera, because their entire sewer system is a combination sewer where they both the storm and sanitary sewers are combined.
Oh, that's one of the worst. Pittsburgh's had huge problems.
Right, and but sitting right on, you know, a big river, with that tends to flood every so often. They're really struggling, and they get lots of overflows, et cetera, on both sides of the river around here, and it's really bad, and it's been neglected for years and years and years. In my house, right there near the river, I got a notice that they were going to finally address that, which was a little concerning because my drain pipes flow right into the sanitary sewer, which they're not supposed to.
Uh-huh.
And then I looked at the date that they were going to deal with, and it's like, yeah, I got 10 years to prepare for this. So yeah, they're just throwing a little pittance of money at it, and just enough to keep people off their backs, but there's just no money. And it's not going to get any better
until Glass-Steagall.
That's right. Well, Dennis, maybe you want to add, but you already said it. Monetarism is gone. That's the only way we're going to do it is create credit, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you can see that's the case because, I mean, if you take that example that John just went through, and you can have similar examples all around our nation right now. Our nation is a shambles at this point. And so it's not that, it really is the case that it's Glass-Steagall or die. It really is the case that if we don't change the way in which we deal with our economy, that our nation is going to collapse. That I think is becoming more and more clear to people. Cause, you know, yeah, remember that, over the last few months, one thing that Mr. LaRouche has been bringing up is that one of the first things that you do after putting Glass-Steagall through is immediately deal with these problems on the state level, because you know we can't balance the budget at the state level. Any attempt to do that is just cutting, you know, and we're seeing the very real effects of that. You know, as you mentioned, with the healthcare workers, the teachers, the first responders, the fire department, people to tend to fighting wildfires, for example. We have had a rash of fires ripping through Texas. These kinds of things. So it's not. It's along with that we're entering a period of greater crisis due to storms and this kind of thing. That crisis is being, instead of being ameliorated, instead of us being able to take precautions, we're taking down our ability to deal with these things, which makes them way worse. And this is not something that can be sustained by any means. You know, Mr. LaRouche has said that the financial system as a whole won't last through the end of the year. And we can start to get a sense of what that actually means by looking at our inability to deal with these types of disasters that we're seeing happen.
Now, let me throw this out. One thing, Dennis, you mentioned in this LPAC video I recommend to everyone that you did recently, Birds Point Levy, who is in charge. You also threw in what has been thrown at the world's population to go along with imperial do nothing about your country, your don't build your nation, namely the green mentality, green fascist mentality. Don't touch anything around you, don't intervene. You want to make that point?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you look at all of the species that have come and gone on this planet, if you look at the majority of the human race which has ever lived, those of us who are alive on this planet right now represent a very, very tiny percentage of all of life. Yet we're the only creature on Earth, or that we're aware of in the universe, that has the ability to willfully deal with these problems, and it's that's something that, well, let's put it this way: when we established this republic in our United States, one thing that we freed ourselves from was the oligarchical tradition of Europe, which suppressed you know, the ability to freely work on different scientific and creative endeavors. And if you look after the establishment of the United States, we've just taken off as a globe. I mean, you look at, for example, the developments of things like the steam engine, the developments that have brought us into space, that we can actually have the capability to even be able to back up the hypothesis of where we are in the solar system. These are discoveries and developments that have occurred over, if you look at geological time, if you look at the how long of a process has been to generate the solar system and generate the Earth and this kind of thing, it's really a blink of an eye how quickly we've been able to make these advances. Once we were able to begin to get a sense of what it means to be free of the oligarchy, and that freedom, that capability of the creative human soul, that's what the green mentality really is out to destroy. It's really it's absolutely anti-human in every respect. Because what does green say? Green says that we need to get along with the beast. That you can't do anything about nature, you can't know anything about earthquakes, you can't, you don't want to mess with nuclear power. It's stuff that you don't understand, and anything that has to do with it is a potential disaster and this kind of thing. It really is putting the chains on our ability as a species to investigate the universe in which we find ourselves. Now, if you counterpose that mentality, that green mentality of run around with the trees and get extinct like every other creature that's walked on the earth, counterpose that with what we've been able to find out about the causes of, well, if not the causes, at least we have evidence of certain phenomena that are associated with seismic activity, with volcanoes, with earthquakes. And the more that we investigate, we see more of a correlation also. We're beginning to get a sense of a system which also contains things like tornadoes, which are which seem to be, at this point, a phenomena having to do with the electric potential of the atmosphere as a whole, which then you see evidenced as a particular kind of cloud formation producing these tornadoes. These are things that we can know. These are things that we can know as individuals in our society. This knowledge can be acted on from the standpoint of policy. And that's the sort of thing that we can do in cooperation with other nations. You take, for example, Russia. If tomorrow, you know, the president of the United States, I'm not saying Barack Obama because he wouldn't do this, but if a president of the United States were to call up Russia tomorrow and say, hey, we've, you know, had our head up our in a hole in the ground we've been being really stupid for a while. Why don't we get together and see about this data, try and start to figure out what's going on with all these precursors? They would happily cooperate on that sort of thing. I mean, this is the type of direction that we need to go in collaboration with other nations. This is the kind of direction that we need to go as a human species. And that fundamentally is the opposite of everything that's embodied in the green technology. I mean, even at the basic level of taking food and using that for fuel, that's just it. Once you're looking at the universe and looking at human potential in the universe from a broader standpoint of what we can actually do in the universe that we find ourselves, then when you look at these policies of solar panels and foodstuffs, it seems really absurd, because it is, and it's actually dangerous. That's what can demonstrate, if we continue with this kind of green mentality, that will be demonstration that we're not fit to survive and that we deserve extinction. Now, I'm not of that mindset at all. I think that, you know, we can do a lot, but we have to do it, you know.
Well, let me throw one thing out, but first you mentioned the thing about the pessimistic, miserable biofuels policy of using corn ethanol and other foodstuffs all around the world that's going on. You know, the imperial spectacle we had this week of the royal wedding in London, I don't know if you missed one thing, is they had a couple of, you know, you take a, LaRouche was saying earlier today, it's a little like it was a big spectacle, but it's really like a funeral for a certain age. This is the end. You take a couple of good-looking people like dolls and you have everyone go through some rituals. But this is the end of this whole system in this era. But one thing the couple rode around in Prince Charles's Aston Martin, which runs on wine. I don't know if you knew that, Dennis. It runs on wine. It does. Anyway. But Carol and John, I haven't known you so long, but I know that for many years, one of the miserable things was a lot of our most highly skilled people, concentrations of workers in the United States, there in that Great Lakes productive belt in Indiana, you know, Kentucky, Ohio, Michigan, Western Pennsylvania, and but they went along due to pessimism in this with this rotten green stuff about how they'd have plenty of jobs for the building trades, for turbines and solar installations and all this kind of stuff. Now, is this finally going out, Carol, in these meetings you've been going to and the discussions you've had? Is this finally being put to rest, this crazy mind control green stuff?
Well, I'm sorry to say that it's not put to rest, but in the building trades, especially like, you know, the electrical, IBEW,
okay,
they are not so much as putting it to rest, but are open to nuclear. It's not like completely, you know, closing that and going all to nuclear, but at least they talk more about nuclear and, you know, but it's a positive. It's definitely a positive. But there's, I'm sorry to say, there's some of the Tea Party people, there's this this same good, this great guy that's so on with Glass-Steagall. He's got this thing that he's pushing for 25 acres. You can grow enough, you know, biofuel to, you know.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
anyway,
that's a sad thing. But I had a question on this science. While we're on this science thing, I wanted to ask Dennis if they've checked into these groups on the internet. This one is called Louisville Skeptics. Louisville Area Skeptics. Mm-hmm. And their talk this week is on, I can't even pronounce this, ecopiosis? Anyways, it says this word, ecopiosis, and then parentheses it says, or could we move life to Mars? And then he says, what's the environment like on Mars? Is there evidence of present or past life on Mars? Could any kind of life survive? You know, so I'm planning on going to this meeting Wednesday night and taking a bunch of, you know, the LaRouche science stuff.
Oh no, I'm not sure about that grouping itself. I'll have to look at it a little bit later. But I mean, that's, you know, that's really the direction we need to go. I mean, if one thing, just in the immediate term, is with looking at figuring out the precursors to earthquakes and volcanoes and figuring out the system as a whole, which produces things like tornadoes and torrential downpours and things of this nature, is that, you know, if you go to Mars, you're that much further out from the sun, such that you can then get a different, data set, a different sense, if you will, of what is happening here on Earth, such that we can begin to really investigate that. But, you know, I think Cody Jones of the Basement Team, he was organizing a while ago in California. He had brought up at a conference there that, you know, one day that sun of ours is going to be done, or it's going to do something which is not going to be very comfortable for us here on Earth. And you know, as whether that day is, you know, a billions of years off, we can know that that is going to be the case. So there's no, it's not just that there's no reason why we shouldn't begin to look at that now, but that's really what we should be investigating right now, is what if we have the capacity, we have the potential to take life, not just us, but you know, life in general, out into the stars, starting with Mars and beyond. You know, yeah, that's the sort of direction that we as a species definitely need to go in, you know?
Right.
Because that's what, I think that's what brings optimism back on the table. Because if you're looking in terms of, you know, monetarism, if you're looking in terms of budgets, then all these things would seem like great ideas, but let's be practical. Let's be realistic. We can't fund this. We'll never do it. They won't let us, right? Which is all a bunch of garbage. Where, you know, when you get a sense of what we're really capable of and then demand that that's the policy, that's the direction we can go.
Yeah. I was talking to Marcia yesterday about this article. I was thinking it was hers. The September 4th, 2009 article on Mars, the next 50 years, you know, where you're looking back from 2059. Mm. And that, to me, I mean, there's so much pessimism and you know, just, you know, austerity, and that's all everybody's looking at and where you can cut. And to shift the thinking and the discussion to what we could be doing instead, you know, mm-hmm. and to get, you know, the Glass-Steagall so that we can get marching onto this. But this article, to me, I'm rereading it for the second or third time. It is just so inspiring and so forward-looking and optimistic. And, you know, this idea, paint this picture of what you want the world to be, you know, and work toward that rather than seeing where the next thing you can cut out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And that's what gives you a sense of mission. That's what gives you a sense of what it means to be an actual human being.
Yes.
That's when you start to touch at what does immortality actually mean? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to contribute to our society in a way that will help to guarantee that our society continues to live? Because I would say that, you know, these things aren't just, you know, good ideas or stuff that we, you know, could be doing or something that would be nice. To my thinking, this is what we are supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really an option. I mean, here we are in a universe where cognizant, we can make discoveries, we can act on them. That's what we're doing. So if any life is going to have a chance at it later on down the road, it's going to be a result of human action. And that's, I think, is a very, very good thing. And it flies in the face of what our society has been telling us for the last 40 years especially, which is that, you know, maybe we're just some kind of statistical accident or some kind of disease scourge of the earth. But this potential is such a beautiful thing. But I'm of the mind too that that's what we have to do. That's like our purpose.
Right. And go ahead. Were you saying something, Carol?
Yeah, I just wanted to say there's one other thing. I mean, we've been doing so much these past couple of weeks, and you know, I'm not working at the moment because my plant is shut down for retooling. So I've got a lot more free time to do this organizing. But to also go to these events, they had a Workers' Memorial Day event two nights ago in Louisville. And there was this young group. It's an artistic group. It's called Looking for Lilith. It's a theater company. And they acted out the Triangle Shirt Factory fire from way back.
Oh, yeah, and, New York. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. And these two, the young women, so passionate and so, you know, centered on, and that's what they do, and we talked to them afterwards. They're theater, political theater, and they try to focus on economic justice. Anyways, we gave them our flyer on Glass-Steagall and talked to them a bit about it, got their contact information, but we were telling them about this little 10-minute thing that John and I put together on Glass-Steagall that we perform.
Okay.
Nothing like what they, I mean, they were awesome. We mostly read ours, but it was a back and forth, and he was the banker, and I was the, you know, the Glass-Steagall pusher. But anyways, I was wondering, Dennis, if you guys talk to, you know, young people that's interested in, you know, like theater and, you know, artistic stuff to pull them in, because I mean, I think it's such a powerful medium.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that Mr. LaRouche has been really going after, these reiterating these past weeks, is that the artistic mind, the beauty of the soul, mm-hmm. when you're looking at a classical composition, that's the essence of how we figure things out in the universe. I mean, when you look at a mathematical formula, that's the tracks. That's what came after that flash of insight, which is the very, and that flash of insight is what a lot of the best dramatists were aiming for, to have the people leave the theater having had some insight into a society which was doomed, so that when they leave the theater, perhaps they will go out and do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really key.
Yeah.
Let me just throw in here, people know they're listening to the LaRouche Show for April 30th, 2011, and we're on LaRouchePub.com. That's where you're listening to the archive. But for those of you who listen customarily by phone, I want to make a specific request here. I'm going to give you the toll-free number. Many of you have it because you're in touch with different liaisons to EIR online, as well as you might be watching LaRouchePack.com every day. But call this number, 800-278-3135. Again, I'll repeat, 800 2783135. For this reason, we different volunteers are cross-firing every kind of piece of information about related to making Glass-Steagall law again in Washington as Congress comes back. And a great deal is available online, as you know. The bill itself, that's 1481, House Bill H.R. 1489. Carol mentioned the Dear Colleague letter of the main sponsor of the bill, Marcy Kaptur from Ohio, is available. There are other resolutions. This isn't a question. This isn't just a petition indefinitely as usual, as Carol implied. This is here and now. We're going to hold people to it. The National Farmers Union is on record for the for Glass-Steagall. Some of the farmers are activating and issuing press releases and pressure. But if you want to check with someone, if you want to crossfire, if you want to arrange a political ambush, right, Carol or John? If you want to check on meetings, if you want to report an opportunity for a political ambush, we are going way beyond any manpower we have, but that's 800-278-3135. Naturally, financial resources are needed. That goes without saying, but I'll tell you, call, figure it out. We are at a threshold, and the last thing we're going to do is hold back at all. We're going to up the pressure, okay? Do you want to add anything to motivate that, John or Carol, or is it self-evident?
Well, the one thing I wanted to add was we have a website that we set up, glassstiegelnow.com.
Oh, you did?
And we're just getting it going. It's pretty rudimentary at this point, but it's got lots of good stuff on there. And it mentions LaRouche a few times and talks about how this is the and it's giving current events as far as the Marcy Kaptur stuff is up there, and we're hoping to get discussion going locally, regionally, and maybe nationally about Glass-Steagall, and maybe get some people out there to understand what the heck it is and why we need it so badly.
Let me ask you one thing. If I'm misinformed, you'll say so, John, but the one thing is in different parts of different parts and ages and everything of our society, veterans as such are a major part with this whole British war policy of let's have plenty of wars all over the place, the long war, destruction of the United States and other nations. Are you working with veterans? Do you know?
Actually, I do. My day job is with a charity that takes care of veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and I guess now Libya. The army is they have a tendency to forget to pay people, and what we do is we take care of them by filling in the gaps here and there. There's also a huge need right now for PTSD. Treatment, and the military is not very good about helping people take advantage of that. They no way they could probably afford it if everybody could get there. So we help them get there, and it's a cool little charity, a little right wing, but it does takes care of the guys who did what we asked.
Well, back to putting together where we started earlier, that we're not going to exist. It's either extinction or a mission for our nation of becoming a nation again, as Dennis said and you both said. That Dennis, you were making the point that move ahead with Glass-Steagall means credit, means jobs, means deploying and creating a future for unemployed citizens. You mentioned that probably in terms of flood cleanup and necessary tasks. But do you want to say anything now? We have about a few seconds towards the end of the show.
Yeah, I mean, if we don't get Glass-Steagall through, and if we don't issue the credit and start rebuilding this nation, then we're going to disintegrate. That's pretty much the thing there,
Yeah, I think last week's LaRouche show was called Glass-Steagall or Die. Oh, we can repeat it again.
Well, Marcia, I'm speaking to the county commissioners on Monday. We're having our little monthly get together with the American Citizen Society on Tuesday. On Wednesday, I'm going to this science thing. On Thursday, we're having our own town hall meeting on Glass-Steagall.
Oh, good. Where is it? Do you want to say that in a concluding time?
Sure. It's in it's right here in Cordon, Indiana.
Okay, and that's on your River County, if that's Harrison County?
Uh-huh.
And
Harrison County.
Right. And that's the, okay, well, that sets the standard. And with that, we've run out of time. But I reiterate, now's it. We're not going to hesitate at all. Go for it. And this will be the conclusion of the LaRouche Show, April 30th, 2011. This is Marcia Mary Baker. I thank John Miller, Dennis Mason, and Carol Smith. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.